Okay, welcome everyone. Excited to have Ralph Kahn. He is, I would say, a profound writer and lecturer. This is the unofficial bio, but I also was pleased to have him as a teacher and give a bracha at my wedding, and definitely a pleasure to have his creativity and brilliance with us in the Matan program, as always. So without further ado, we'll begin. I'm Sarah Bali Chaim.
And I was very fortunate to have you as a student. Regarding the topic, a little bit of an introduction. There are a few topics that we find that the amount of misinformation or disinformation is somewhat overwhelming. What we're going to try to do is read some of what I'm going to call the necessary sources, which means, as you note, you're going to have, if you can't sleep tonight, you can go through all the sources that I didn't get to today. And I left a lot over here. And sometimes, when I prepare sources, I actually, if I send you 11 or 12 pages, it means that at home I have another 15 or 20 pages that I didn't send you or didn't present in front. But what I'd like to do is that if somebody ever wants to teach the topic, that they'll have everything they need to actually teach it, rather than just cherry pick some things. And cherry picking is actually something that I want to come back to. When I said before misinformation, disinformation, part of the reason for this is it's a radicalism of vegetarianism or veganism or so on, where it seems to be that it's not sufficient for someone, especially who's a Jew or an Orthodox Jew, a practicing Jew, to say that I choose not to eat meat, but rather they go searching for sources that will then not just defend that position, but will rather strengthen that position as if it were some type of a dominant position. And I'm saying things now before we even start, because I know at the end I'm going to run out of time. So I want to say certain things right now. One has to be very careful when dealing with issues that will deal with public policy. Just for example, if somebody, especially a rabbi, who's going to get up and say, well, we believe that in today's world that we have a sustainable life without eating meat, which, by the way, I believe to be true. I don't think any of us need to eat meat. And therefore, my conclusion is that there's no justification for the slaughtering of animals. Just realize that certain people who may not necessarily be lovers of Jews in certain countries in Europe then may use that statement in order to say, let's outlaw Shechita completely because it's even according to Jewish law, it's something which is not necessary. So I'm just pointing out that there is a certain responsibility when it comes to issues that deal with public policy, and one, even though believes that they have a very rightful battle to fight, and therefore they really believe that, let's say, issues like Tzar Bar Lechaim would leave one to the conclusion that one should not eat any meat whatsoever. Years ago, Rabbi Lichtenstein, who I was fortunate to study with for a number of years, wrote an article, and it's an important article, and it was something to the effect, the title was, does Judaism recognize an ethic independent of halacha? Or essentially to say, does halacha really dominate every single issue of our lives? And maybe it feels that way sometimes. You know, you can look in the Shulchan Aruch and see which shoe to put on first in the morning, which one to put on and which one to tie, and you can go on and on and on. But nonetheless, Torah leads us, Torah, the halacha, the rabbis, despite what some of us at times may feel otherwise, there's lots and lots of room for independent thought and independent decisions, and there's issues of morality and indecency, which halacha doesn't necessarily dictate which choice that you should make in that particular case, which means that it's not that every single decision that I make, which means, saying that a little differently, I can choose to be a vegetarian, and it doesn't have to be that my conclusion is because halacha has to say it. And the other thing is, I can't use what's called in the Midrash midat stom when it comes to halacha, meaning I cut it down to, you know, in stom, if you didn't fit in the bed, they stretch to you or they cut you down to size. Unfortunately, people have that kind of attitude towards Jewish law sometimes, and they make it fit into whatever it is my particular belief system is, or more what I believe my morality system is, and therefore I try to make halacha fit into it. I don't feel that it's always wise, and I don't feel that it's necessary. And on top of all of that, I feel that it's much worse than that, because misrepresenting what Torah says, I believe, is one of the most serious things possible. And maybe it sounds like I'm overstating that, but if you can't trust people when they're telling you what Jewish law actually says, then really the whole system falls apart. There's even a Yam Shel Shlomo, which is quite celebrated, which is not for our topic today, it's in Baba Kama, and he says that misrepresenting Torah is Yahorig Val Yavar. He brings proof from a passage of the Gemara that a person should rather let themselves be killed than misrepresenting what the Torah says. By the way, it doesn't mean that I need to have full disclosure on every single point in halacha. There were times somebody can ask me a question and I can say I prefer not to answer. Or when you learn a little bit more, I'll give you that answer. But to misrepresent what it says is something which is quite severe. So now let's try to take a look. And I'm going to start with the following couple of words before we begin. Tsar Balei Chaim, which literally means causing pain to living beings, Tsar, pain, Balei Chaim, to living beings, is debated in the Gemara, is debated by the Rishonim, and is debated by the Achronim, if there is such a law on a Torah level or not. Which means the phrase, Tsar Balei Chaim D'Oraita, Tsar Balei Chaim is a Torah law, itself is sometimes said as a statement, and sometimes is said with a question mark. And sometimes is said, no, Tsar Balei Chaim is D'Rabbanan. So I'm saying right there is not a consensus in the Gemara. Gemara has both voices. In Rishonim, there are both voices. In the Shulchan Aruch, we're going to find, Shulchan Aruch and commentaries, there are two voices to this. So right away as a starting point, to realize that Tsar Balei Chaim is not necessarily a Torah law. The second point, which is connected to the first point, is what is Tsar Balei Chaim? What are the parameters of Tsar Balei Chaim? I remember years ago, and this will sound like an overstatement, and it's not. Years ago, when we were thinking what to do with my kids on a nice summer day, and I think one of the kids said, let's go horseback riding. And then the thought went through my mind, hold it a second. Why am I allowed to ride on a horse? Does it bother the horse? Is that Tsar Balei Chaim? Just because I want to go on ride on an animal, what gives me that permission? So we actually were not so far from this place then. And predictably, the guy gave me the right answer. I said, does the horse suffer at all? So he looked at all of us. None of us were terribly overweight. And he said, no, the horse actually enjoys going out for it. I don't know if it's true or not true. I don't know enough about horses. But he says, no, the horse will enjoy the going out and whatever. So therefore, I determined that there should be no problem with Tsar Balei Chaim. But really, what are the parameters? Where do I draw the line on this? And there's one more thing that I want to keep in mind as we're going to move forward, and ultimately we're going to get to a tshuva from Rav Moshe, is that if there is a problem with Tsar Balei Chaim, someplace along the way, if you want, we can call this the food chain. Someplace along the way, there is a problem with Tsar Balei Chaim. Does that then necessarily tell me that food that was produced along the way, is that food not kosher? A number of times people have tried to get me sign on things that showed horrific images or depictions of animals traveling across the world on a boat in terrible, terrible conditions and say, oh, this food is, the animals which were brought over in these conditions are not kosher and I should sign on this and so on. I absolutely refused to sign on such a document, because I don't believe that the way that the animal was treated necessarily tells me the animal is kosher or not kosher. Which means the laws of kosher, again, there's lots and lots of material. If you want to learn all of the laws of kashrut, in the Shulchan Aruch, there's lots and lots of things to learn. How the animal is treated prior to the point it was shechted is not one of the considerations, whether it's kosher or not kosher. And that goes back to my first point in terms of my own personal morality and ethics. It could be that I'm going to say, you know what? I don't want to be the beneficiary of an animal that was treated in a certain way. I don't want to support an industry. But I don't want to say that something's not kosher if it is kosher, because I feel that that's not just not telling the truth. That has unbelievable ramifications to it. And really suffers from lack of intellectual honesty. Source number one is Gemara on Baba Metzia. And over here it's talking about helping somebody loading an animal or unloading an animal. And this is a point which is discussed in the Torah. Omer le hamani Rabbi Yosi Aglilihi de'amer tsar Balei Chaim deraita. See, notice right away. This, and I know we just cut in the middle, this is the opinion of Rabbi Yosi Aglili. Rabbi Yosi Aglili, he's of the opinion that tsar Balei Chaim claims the right. And by the way, if you're a little sensitive to how to read Talmudic texts, you now realize that's not a universal statement, because otherwise it wouldn't have to qualify by saying, oh, Rav Yossi Aglili is the one who says that Tsar Balei Chaim deraita, which means there is another side to this. Toshma, come in here. Ohev lefrok v'sone l'ton. If you have two different mitzvah opportunities, one is somebody who is called an ohev. An ohev over here is somebody, let's call it, it's a friend, somebody who you have a good relationship with, and they need help to unload an animal. Let's say to unload a donkey from all the things that are on its back. Visone, and there's somebody who you can't stand, somebody who you hate, l'ta'on, needs help to load up the donkey. So now, if Tsar Balei Chaim is on a Torah level, and this animal's been traveling for a bit, and has on its back this whole weight on it, it would seem to be that the proper thing to do is to unload the animal to help alleviate the pain or discomfort that it's experiencing. Nonetheless, and the Torah, not only that, it stresses, even if there's somebody that you can't stand, somebody that you hate, sonen, needs help unloading it, you should still unload it, and by the way, unload it, and that may be one of the sources that Tsar Bailei Chaim is deraita, that even somebody who you hate, you should help unload. But over here, the Gemara presented us with a funny case. Ohev lefrok, somebody who you like needs help to unload, v'soni lit'on, he needs help to put it on. Now, this should be a no-brainer. This should be very simple, that you have to help the person who you like and help his animal unload, because Tsar Bailei Chaim is deraita. Very simple. The Gemara nonetheless says something which is totally counterintuitive. And by the way, you can give a whole shir, or certainly a whole Dvar Torah, just on this one little point. It says, mitzvah bisone. The mitzvah is to help the one that you hate. Now that itself is fascinating, because it also could have said, mitzvah is to help the animal, but it's not. Mitzvah bisone. But why? Kidei l'chof et yitzro. In order to force your yetzer hara. Now, you never expected your Yetzer Hara to make an appearance in the middle of a discussion like this. And there are incredible implications of this statement. First, I want to read a little bit more and then try to explain this. And if you're of the opinion that the pain of an animal is a Torah law, that you should certainly be doing first. That should certainly be the thing that you have an obligation to do. Afilu hachi, nonetheless, kidei l'chof et yitzer adif. Nonetheless, to force your Yetzer Hara is preferable. So, what do we want first? The explanation or the implications? I guess it would make more sense, the explanation. Explanation would be as follows. And we're going to see this as we move on. I just want to make sure that we don't miss it, and it's very, very clear. Tsar Bailei Chaim means not that you caused pain to an animal, that you caused unnecessary pain to an animal. Which, of course, all of you can now ask me, so what's necessary? And the answer to what's necessary, if there is reasonable, now that's the most impossible word in the whole sentence, because all of us will now then debate forever what is reasonable. If there's reasonable human gain to be made from the pain the animal will experience. So therefore, for example, I can look at a verse that says that, you know, for 6 days you work, on the seventh day you rest, not only do you rest, you and your animal shall rest. Hold it. If Tsar Bailei Chaim's deraita, why am I allowed to hook up that thing on the back of the animal for 6 days of the week? Why do I only have to take it off on the seventh day of the week? Why don't I just say Tsar Bailei Chaim deraita? I'm not allowed to ever have some animal, a beast of burden. I'm not allowed to ever have something work for me. I'm not allowed to ever put something. Why did the Torah say that I should help somebody take the thing off of the animal, the weight after the animal of the person I hate? Say, don't put anything on the animal, because there's no such law. Because the Torah understood that for, and I'm going to use that word, for reasonable human benefit, I am allowed to put an animal through discomfort. The only thing about Tsar Bailei Chaim is that I can't put an animal through discomfort when there is no human benefit. Now, what is the amazing implication of this law? That human benefit is not only what I would call practical human benefit. I need to travel from place to place. I need to work my field. I need to bring things from place to place. Human benefit is even in terms of the Yetzer Hara. So that now we have to go back and unpack that a little bit, what that whole thing was about. When I have two people, even I can go back to Adam, v'kiv shuha, Adam's interrelationship with the animals. It's not a question of equality. So now let's go back, and as I said, let's try to unpack that issue in terms of the Yetzer Hara. Two animals over here, one of them is about to be loaded, one of them is about to be unloaded. I have two people over here, one is a friend and one is an enemy. Based upon basic Jewish law, there is no question, until we raise the question, there's no question that I should help unload the animal of my friend. Because when it's said in the Torah, you unload the animal of your enemy, what it really meant is you unload the animal even of your enemy. Don't let your personal relationship dictate that this animal should suffer. Just because you can't stand this guy doesn't mean his animal should suffer. And as I said, that could very well be the basis of those who argue that Tsar Bailei Chaim is a deraita, is a Torah law, because look, even if you can't stand the guy, you still have to help him unload the animal. So if that's the case, then why in the world, when the person I need to help is my friend, so therefore I don't need the kal v'chomer, right? You don't have to pull out the thumb and go like that. I don't need the kal v'chomer. I should help the animal of the person that I like. And as I said, this is a no-brainer. It should take nothing whatsoever. So how in the world does the Gemara get to the opposite conclusion? Because what's going to go on, and this is what I think is the fascinating part. I wrote this someplace in one of my books, and I think I call the title Soul Matters. This is essentially the issue. What would go through the human being's mind? What would we be processing at this point? Okay, this guy I hate, this guy I like, this guy I have to help because of his animal. And as I'm doing that mitzvah, would my Yetzer Tov be happy, or would my Yetzer Hara be happy? It's like I look at the guy that I can't stand, and I say, listen, sorry, I'd love to help you, but the Torah says I got to help his animal because I have to unload it. Now, as I'm either saying that or processing this or doing this, I'm going to say it again. Am I at that point really becoming a more elevated human being? Or is my Yetzer Hara at that point, if I can speak in such terms, saying, wow, isn't this Torah great? I get to totally diss this guy that I can't stand because I have to help this other animal. And the Torah says, no. The Gemara says, sorry, no. Go help the guy that you can't stand, load his animal, l'chof et yitzro, in order to somehow heal your Yetzer Hara. So I'm going to go back to what I said before about the definition of tzar bar lechaim. Tzar bar lechaim is that you're allowed to cause animal discomfort where there is human benefit. In this case, there's human benefit, and essentially human benefit is that he needs to go through some kind of, shall we say, spiritual therapy in order to take away this hatred from his heart, because when you're doing a mitzvah and your Yetzer Hara is quite happy, there's something wrong with that picture. So I'm saying that's what emerges from this Gemara, and I think just right there is a snapshot. That's a very, very interesting concept. But as I said, that's what emerges. So again, if it's the case where your enemy is unloading, that's a pasuk in the Torah. Help your enemy unload. So therefore, I would think certainly I should help my friend unload. But over here, my friend needs unloading, and therefore tzar bar lechaim, and my enemy needs help unloading. Nonetheless, the Gemara said you should help your enemy because of l'chofetz yitzro. In order to, that takes precedence. I'm saying that's what's interesting about this Gemara, and that's the point that we would not have anticipated by ourselves. But I think that's a perfect Gemara that helps us to understand what exactly are the parameters of Tzar Bar Lechaim, where there's human benefit to be made. And over here, human benefit is including the psychological or the spiritual outlook of an individual in order to create some kind of a healing, to create some kind of a balance. And I'll say it again, the Gemara doesn't seem to like this idea that your Yetzer Hara can be excited and happy because you're doing a mitzvah, because there's something wrong with that picture. Okay, so I'm saying that helps us a lot in terms of understanding the parameters of Tzar Bar Lechaim, and essentially what we're going to have to do, everything we're going to do afterwards, is just going to follow my analysis of what this Gemara said. There is some debate to take place. Who is this enemy? Is this enemy, and the Gemara goes into this, the Rambam will see goes into this, who's this enemy? Is the enemy somebody who is my enemy because I'm a bad person? Or is this person my enemy because they're a bad person? And that would seem to make a very big difference. Part of the reason to make a difference, because I think all legal systems deal with obligations on the one hand and then benefits on the other hand, or rights or privileges on the other hand. And what happens at times is people don't live up to their obligations and they lose privileges. If you want, in American law, you can say one of the privileges of society is the freedom of movement. If you are guilty of a felony, you'll find yourself locked in prison and you've lost the privilege of freedom of movement. And I can use this in lots of other examples along the way. Over here, the individual who is, I don't like them, so that's a subjective analysis, or they don't deserve to be liked, that would be more of an objective analysis, because they are somebody who are not befitting to have received help from other human beings, generally because of things that they've done. So with that little bit, we'll look at the Rambam in source number 2. Hapogeya b'shnayim echad raveitz tachat masova echad parek me'alav v'lo matzah mishtonimo. Essentially, the Rambam is restating our Gemara. There are two different animals. Mitzvah l'frok b'tchila mishum tzar bar lechayim. The achrach to'ein. That the mitzvah fundamentally is always to help to unload the animal because of tzar bar lechayim, and then help the other person load up the animal. B'midvar amurim, what are we talking about? Kishu shneim sonim o'avim. If both people were either both people that were hated or both people that liked. Aval im haya echad sonei v'echad ohev mitzvah l'to'on im sonei t'chila k'dei l'chof et yitzro hara. That if one of them was somebody who I don't like, but again, I'm going to qualify that in a moment, somebody who is a sonei, we won't make the value judgment why, somebody who is disliked, so then I should help them L'chof et yitzro hara, in order for me to force my yitzah hara. So now, just in case you thought that was some kind of a fluffy idea, what the Rambam just now, our like uber rationalist, the Rambam, again, he may well very well have been not just a physician, maybe a psychiatrist as well, and the Rambam understands this as, and he paskins this way in terms of dealing with the yitzah hara. So I'm saying that also, I think just now became a little bit more interesting. The Rambam then qualifies as we move forward. Who's this person I don't like? It's a Jew. And how does a Jew get to a situation that he hates another Jew? You shouldn't hate someone in your heart. So you don't like this person because you know that they are, for lack of a better term, a spiritual lowlife. That's what the Rambam says over here. You know about this person's misdeeds, and you've warned them, you've spoken to them, and they just keep on doing what they do. Even though they haven't done tshuva, and they're still a spiritual misfit, and you see them having this difficult time, don't leave the person by themselves. Because the person may find themselves getting into a difficult physical situation. And the Torah said that the Torah was careful about human lives. And so on and so forth. And I'm not going to read the rest of this, but this Rambam really is quite interesting and deserves more than the attention I'm giving it now. Just as an aside, the Rambam deals with the Yetzira in multiple places. One that I'm not going to mention, which is really important, and I probably should have brought it, is when he deals with forcing somebody to give a get. He says that you can beat them, ad she omerotzani, you can beat them until they say yes, and then the Rambam qualifies. Well, just a little background, you're not allowed to force someone to give a get. The get is not going to be kosher, but the Rambam says you can beat him to an inch of his life. But if you beat him, then how is that allowed? And then the Rambam says, well, you can beat him because he really wants to do the right thing, but it's Yetzer Hara that doesn't do the right thing. So you beat his Yetzer Hara until he's able to make the right decision. And when Rav Soloveitchik commented on this, he said, think about the Gemara in Nida on Daf Lamed, Lamed Aleph, which it says that before a person is born, an angel comes and teaches them the entire Torah. So he says, essentially, Torah is telling us that inside a person's mind or heart or soul, we are all programmed to do the right thing because the angel taught us to do the right thing. And therefore, that's not just some nice agadic statement. He says, that's a halacha that we are programmed to do the right thing, and therefore you're able to beat somebody because the Yetzer Hara is a little bit too strong. They need some spiritual therapy. And source number three, it's a Rambam in Temura, which I will readily admit is a little bit off the beaten track, where he says, V'kol eidvarim kedei l'chof et yitzro ulatakein deyotav. And then all of these things, you don't know what all of these things are, but he says all of these things are here in order to force our Yetzer Hara to get in line and to fix our deot. Our deot would be our world outlook. V'rov dini ha-Torah einan ela etzot me'rachok migdol ha-etzah l'takena deot u'l'asher kol ha-ma'asim. And he goes, that's really what the Torah is about, in order to make us into decent people, which goes back to my point. If you're fulfilling a mitzvah Torah, and you are not decent while you're doing it, and it's strengthening your indecency by saying, oh, look, to this guy you can't stand, sorry, I can't help you, so then it obviously, there's something wrong over here, and that's why that gets flipped. And once again, for our purposes, in terms of Tzar Ba'alei Chayim, we come to the conclusion that what is Tzar Ba'alei Chayim? The initial conclusion, which we're not going to move from, what is Tzar Ba'alei Chayim? Tzar Ba'alei Chayim is unnecessary pain for an animal. What makes something necessary? Because there's human gain from it. How far can I stretch human gain? Even in terms of a person's psychological, religious, social needs are included within human gain, and I think that is really quite clear what emerges from what we've seen so far. Are we good? This law that we've seen so far from the Gemara and the Rambam makes its way to the Shulchan Aruch in source number 4, and I'm not going to belabor the point. It's the same thing. It's here as well. In source number 5, which we're also not going to learn, is Rabbi Soloveitchik telling us that this consideration is not an external consideration. It's part of the laws of Tzar Ba'alei Chayim. It's part of the laws of helping load or unload. Built into this is this larger consideration of what, in a sense, we can call the macro consideration over here. And incidentally, that itself should be an independent topic when in Judaism do we look at things in terms of the micro and when we look at things in terms of the macro? I think that this is actually one of the most important issues in terms of halakha, because I think that's very often people, including whole groups of people, get caught in micro considerations without appreciating the macro. And over here, essentially what Rav Soloveitchik is telling us, that don't look at this in terms of the micro. There's a macro consideration over there, and this is built into the very laws themselves. Yes, the question was, it seems as if the whole issue of Tzar Bale Chaim is really about the Yetzer Hara. No. Tzar Bale Chaim is really about the animal. But the issue of Tzar Bale Chaim is, it's unnecessary pain for an animal. So all that I've tried to show you is an extreme example of what's not considered to be unnecessary. So don't take the extreme as being a definition of everything, that it's all about Yetzer Hara. It's not. That's just, I felt that was a good way of showing you how extreme this goes, and I think it's going to help us as we move on. But as I said, this is absolutely an extreme application. But once you see that the Gemara says it, and the Rambam says it, and the Shulchan Aruch rules this way, then you realize that this is actually a thing, and it's not just my imagination, that even when it comes to the Yetzer Hara, I'm allowed to cause Tzar Bale Chaim. Even if I conclude that Tzar Bale Chaim is a Torah law, nonetheless, human benefit ends up being more important than it, and even in terms of the spiritual side of the person, and not just the physical benefit. That's not what we would have anticipated with that introduction. Oh, Tzar Bale Chaim is deraita. And therefore, I have to help even my enemy. And therefore, because it's all about the animal. So that's essentially the shift, which I think was so important. The shift is, it's about the animal to becoming no, but it's about the animal, but with one really important proviso, and that is where there's no human benefit. Now, how far can I stretch human benefit? So that's what I try to show you. And again, if I didn't read the source in the Shulchan Aruch, it's there in the Shulchan Aruch as well. So I'm not going to say, please trust me, but if you want, we can read it. And that's what I said in the beginning. The Gemara will debate whether Tzar Bale Chaim deraita or not, and in this case, it doesn't make a difference. Even if it's deraita, you still have to help your enemy even load the animal, which then takes us back to, as I said, my conclusion, therefore, is that human benefit is really the issue over here, or that's really the parameter. We're not talking about the kind of person who you can't have a grudge against. We're dealing with the kind of person who you can have a grudge against, because it's not my subjective not liking them, it's objectively they've done things which are really immoral. So therefore, that's why I talked about privileges and so on. They are no longer deserving of the privileges. Still, doesn't make a difference because my Yetzer Hara is going to enjoy not helping that person. So I'm saying that it's just a fascinating point in terms of the Gemara. I'm saying that's why that is really so important. Are we good? As usual, we have to get into triage already at this point, and to see how we proceed. In source number 6, there's a verse that has nothing to do with us. It'll be cited, but then will be interpreted by Rashi, and it's the Rashi that we will then meet along the way. It's a source that you should be familiar if you ever started reading Tehillim, because it's the first chapter and the first pasuk. Ashrei ha'ish asher lo halach ba'atzat rasha'im uv'derech ha'tim lo amad uv'moshe rav leitzim lo yashav. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah has a drasha on this. Darash Rav Shimon ben Pazi, ashrei ha'ish asher halach litarteot lekarek sa'ot. He didn't go to theater and the theaters, and he didn't go to the circuses. Shel goyim, which, by the way, generally were not just places of entertainment, generally were places of quite immoral behavior taking place over there on all kinds of levels. Uvederech ha'taim lo amad, zeshel lo amad b'kenigyon. So now, of course, our problem will be knowing what kenigyon means. The way that the translation over here, which is based on the Steinsaltz, the Davidson translation, has it as bestial contests, which means where you have two lions attacking one another and ripping one another to shreds, and you sit in the Colosseum and you're watching this, or for that matter, they would have competitions between the lions and the Christians, and the lions always won. It was quite predictable. I probably should have used the Bears if we're from Chicago. That's the way that it's understood over here in this translation. Rashi, however, gives a different translation. In source number 8, Rashi writes, "Kinegion tzedat chaya al yedei klavim v'kol maseim l'shem tzchok v'simcha." He says you are going hunting, and you have your dogs chasing after the prey, and all things like this, and you do this l'shem tzchok u'simcha, which means he's not talking about, you know, trying to catch. Again, all of you can in your minds picture certain people, and I guess we've seen scenes like this. Inevitably, they have British accents and all, as they're off in the hunt going chasing after the poor animal. And that's fascinating, because that's exactly what Rashi is describing, and doing it out of schok v'simcha. So now, what I want to add is there's somebody here can have a little bit of chutzpah, to be the kind of person who used to get kicked out of class a lot, and say, well, if there's schok and simcha, that means there was human benefit. You were about to say that, right? And you did get kicked out of class a lot, right? No.
It's not me. Right. In my old age,
it's good for you then. It's helpful to say this. You say, hold it. The schok and simcha is also of human benefit. It's therapeutic. I'm sure I can get my psychiatrist sign off on this today, how this is something which is really beneficial. Nonetheless, over here we have a verse. By the way, we're not dealing with an isur necessarily, just something which David HaMelech, which is understood by the Gemara and the way that Rashi crosses. There's actually a fascinating commentary to Ahavterech Kamocha based on a sadistic and approach. One of the Balei HaTosfot brings it up. What if Ahavterech Kamocha? What if, or you're a masochist, even better, you're a masochist and Ahavterech Kamocha. What do you do with that? So we won't answer that question. If you're really interested, you'll send me an email and I'll send you the source. So let's and it's cited in the crowns of the letters. Now you have to go looking for that. In the Shulchan Aruch and Aruch Chaim, source number 9, Shin Tet Zayin, it's talking about laws of Shabbat. Tzad Tzvi Yashim. Okay, so it's talking about hunting on Shabbat, which is one of Lamatet Melachot. The Ramah then adds, HaMishaseh Kelev Acher Chaya B'Shabbat. You use your dog to go chasing after an animal on Shabbat, Havitzeda. That is included in the Torah law not to go hunting on Shabbat. I can't go hunting. I can't have my dog hunt for me. And then the Ramah adds, V'yesh omrim, and some say, V'af b'chol asur letzud b'klavim mishir moshev leitzim. And it's interesting that whoever did these realize something. Parentheses in the Shulchan Aruch is a world unto itself, and we have no idea who wrote a lot of them. And over here, whoever stuck this in wrote the Or Zarua, based on the Gemara. I personally would have said, look at Rashi on the Gemara. I think Rashi is a little more well-known and more accessible. Rashi said that on the Gemara, the same Gemara he's quoting, in Avodah Zarah. So that's interesting how that then makes its way into the Shulchan Aruch, that again, Shabbat law, moving into, maybe that's not allowed at all. Okay, next. Next is going to be the Truman Hadeshin. I give you all kinds of background information to know who we're talking about. He's actually a quite important Ashkenazi posek. And the reason is because he had a great deal of influence on the Ramah. You'll see as I read the introduction. Born in 1390, died in 1460. Talmidus, Talachis, best known Truman Hadeshin, which serves as one source of the Mapah. The Mapah is the Ramah in the Shulchan Aruch, so he is really one of his go-to sources. He has two volumes of his work. There is a very powerful, I don't even want to call it a rumor, but it's, I would say, almost common knowledge that his first volume of Shelot and Tshuvot were all made-up questions. Which means, why trust people to ask you good questions and you have good answers you want to write about? Make up your own questions. And there are certain books written today as well that I have very strong suspicions about. I don't believe people ask them these questions and they just decided they wanted to give answers. I won't say the names of those books right now, but as I said, I have some strong suspicions. Over here, he writes the following question. In Limrot Notzot La'avazot Chayim, am I allowed to pull out the feathers of a goose? Now, goose feathers are something which could be of great human need, especially you live in a cold place during the winter, you want to make your blanket or something out of it. But what if the animal happens to still be alive? Can you pull out the goose feathers of a live animal? That essentially is his question. And as he phrases it, he says, "Idoma legizat kvasim." Is it the same thing as shearing your sheep, which is something which is done all the time? O havi tsar balei chayim. Or is this a problem of tsar balei chayim? Now, this is going to really be one of the most important discussions on this case. So let's, yes?
It could be this is going to be addressed, but I would see sheep shearing as tremendously different than, goose feather plucking, just in terms of the contact with the animal skin and the pain it's causing the animal.
Of course, which is why you have to suspect that anybody really asking this question, or does he have a point he wants to make?
Right.
Okay. Gam lichtof lashon ha'ov k'dei sheyidaber, v'oznayim v'zanav mikelev k'dei liyafoto. So he's just talking about all kinds of things, damages that you can do to animals, or all these kinds of things. Nir'in ha'dvarim de'in asur mishum tzar be'lechayim, im hu'osed l'tzorchav u'latash mishel. He goes, it would seem to me that all things are allowed when there is human benefit. Again, he just now said it. We inferred this. I thought this was quite obvious, but you know, you never trust me on such things, right? We've said this many times. Dead rabbis are far more believable than any live rabbis could possibly be. And this is an important rabbi. Again, the Truman Adeshin is an important rabbi, again, very authoritative. And then he writes, and this is like his really takeaway line, Dilo nivru'u kol habriyot rak l'shamesh et ha'adam, that all animals are created in order for human benefit, which then just now sets the standards. Again, we have to go back to all kinds of cases. Ki de'it beperek patra de kedushin. Viteda, and no, and now he goes back to our case in Bav Metzia, chashiv pri katzar ba'alei chayim, v'imkein heich mutar masak kaved. He goes that one of the considerations of unloading an animal is because of tzar ba'alei chayim, and he says, hold it a second. Again, please realize something. Imkein, and I said this in passing in the very beginning, heich mutar masak kaved ba'al b'emto l'holichom b'mkom l'kom, ha'ikot tzar ba'alei chayim. He goes, if tzar ba'alei chayim was really absolute, and in terms of the animal, why is only taking the load off the animal the mitzvah? You never should have been allowed to put the load on in the first place, but obviously he wants to tell us a very specific point, and that is where there is human benefit, there is no problem of tzar ba'alei chayim. He goes into our case, and again, he says, oh, we're dealing with wicked people, and obviously that's not the case, but rather anything where there is human benefit. Look at the bottom line of the page where it's bolded, mitoch halin ra'ayot, and because of all the evidence I just now brought, havenir ektsat deleke isur bekai gavne, ela shaha'olam nizharim v'nimna'im. Ve'efshur tam lefi she'en rotze ha'olam linhog mita tachzoriot neged habriyot. She'erim dilma yikablu onish al-kacha. So he says, that going back to pulling out the feathers, he says it's really allowed. But on the other hand, people don't want to be cruel. Which means he's. Remember what I said in the very beginning about where you draw the line, and does halacha have to embrace everything? Which means something could be allowed. It doesn't mean that I have to do it. Which means animals are created for human need. Does that mean that I am allowed to pull out? Yes, I'm allowed to. Because but people stay away from doing these things. And he says why? Because people don't want to be cruel. Again, ve'efshar tam lefisha einam rotzim ha'olam lenhog midat achzariot neged abriot she'yirein dilmi yikavlu onish alkacha, and they're afraid that maybe they'll be punished for this. And by the way, he's not convinced at all that there's any punishment which is coming because he thinks it's allowed. Nonetheless, he goes, people don't want to be cruel. V'afagav tehefte gomurhu l'shchota egel achilato. And for example, even though it's 100% allowed to kill a calf to eat, afilu hachi nenesh v'kebel yisurin alkacha. Achakach yigidu li shenimtza ken bepiske ri beperikamo. V'od deleka isur tzabar lechayim elam ken de'en l'revach. And he goes, the only, and we'll come back to the re and the piske re, I'll explain what that is in a moment, but what he says is that whenever there's human benefit, then one cannot speak of tzar ba'alei chayim. In source 11, the Ramah predictably brings the Trumat Hadeshin. So again, this Trumat Hadeshin is not just this obscure source, it makes its way into the Shulchan Aruch, which I'm going to again say should have been predictable based on the introduction. And he writes, V'yesh mish, now this is in Simon Reshkaf Gimel. It's talking about what kind of things you should say a Shechiyanu on. Now some of you may know that you don't say a Shechiyanu, for example, on shoes. It's made out of leather. Leather comes from animals and so on. V'yesh mish katav she'in lomer kein amin alav o bigadim nasime arot. There are some who say that you don't say a Shechiyanu on something which is made out of leather. Shoes or those of you with your leather clothing, shel beima de imkein, or you tzrichim lahamit beima acher tchila shechadesh beged acher, because you're killing animals to do this. Uktiv rachamav kol ma'asav, and it says that you know God has compassion for all of His creation. And by the way, look at what he's quoting is the Truman Hadeshin b'psakav. That's where it's coming from. V'neya tam chalush ma'od ve'enu nir'eh. I know you weren't expecting that conclusion. He goes, that's really a weak argument, and that does not seem like a plausible consideration. Nonetheless, a lot of people don't like to say a shechion on it, which means actually the bottom line of the Ramah is on a new pair of shoes, you do, everybody knows this. This is one of the things everybody knows, you don't say shechion on a pair of shoes. But take a look, actually the Ramah didn't say it. He said, yeah, somebody who says it, it's really a weak argument, but a lot of people connect to that argument, so therefore they don't do it. So essentially, if you ever got a pair of shoes and you feel really happy to really expensive pairs of shoes, it's like mamish lefnei iver, right? So it could be you bought one of these pairs of shoes and really are much happier than many other things that you do say a Shachianu on. According to the Ramah, you feel happy. You absolutely can say a Shachianu on that, even though it really seemed to have been like common wisdom, common knowledge that you don't. In the Shulchan Aruch, in Yeridea this time, in source number 12, we're dealing with things that can make something into a trefa. We're going to read a little bit, and then we're going to get to the point that I want to focus on. I see now what we're missing. I actually had all of the Ramah in red. Is that the way it is on the... look at this. It's much nicer here. And in the sources in front of you, you don't see it. All of you should insist on getting the digital version as well, that they should send this to you also. Okay. So in source number 12, Nimtza kotz beveshet larko l'rechvo, if you find some kind of a kotz, there's something within the neck by the veshet, which could make it into a trefa, the animal into trefa, and we're going to skip a little bit. We'll get to the Ramah, which is in the third line, Hagah. The yesh makshirim ein koret dam ibachutz. There's no kind of a blood clot. We're not worried that maybe it got sick, it got better, and chule. V'chein nagu lahakel bi'irenu, boto avazot, shemal itin lasot mehem shuman. And those geese that we force feed in order to make them fatter, in order to get schmaltz, that's what, there's no other word for this, to get a good deal of schmaltz from this goose, he goes, that's our custom, that's what we do. So actually, force-feeding geese is not just, you say, hold it, that's a problem, how can you do this? No, actually the Ramah says that this is something which is the custom that we do over here. And then they go looking afterwards and so on. And I'm just going to leave it at that. Yeah?
So it's okay because it's our custom.
Yes, how's that?
I mean, here he's bringing it in to address a different issue altogether. He's just bringing it in as a by the way, you know, without him addressing the charge on the kindness.
Again, they're worried when you force... get to the point. He's worried about force feeding, not in terms of the Tzar Bar Lechayim, because he's probably had some foie gras as well and knows that there's human benefit involved in this, but rather what he's worried about is something completely different. He's worried about when you force feed it, did you make it into a trefa? Which means he's dealing with a technical halachic problem. Is this process one which will produce animals which are not kosher? Again, it's fascinating because somebody who's going to argue, oh, this is not kosher in Jewish law because you're causing the animal to suffer, I think I can reasonably say, you know, in front of all of us right here, well, that's nice, but the Ramah doesn't agree to that. Quite the opposite. The Ramah has no problem with force-feeding it, and not only does he have no problem force-feeding it, he says that's the custom, is that we force-feed it in order to make the animals or the geese, to make them fatter. That's what we do. And the only consideration is if technically we made the animal into a trefa by virtue of something going into its neck and maybe hitting something which would make it not kosher. So with him, it's really a technical issue, and anybody who thought, oh, no, we should be making a much broader statement over here, I'm going to go back to what I said before. You don't want to eat this because you feel that this is not right, that's fine. I have no problem with it. But don't try to go and misquote, by the way, there are those who misquote the Ramah. This Ramah has been misquoted as to saying, oh, this is a problem with Tzar Bar Lechayim. But I don't know how clearer I can be when I say, no, this is not a problem of Tzar Bar Lechayim. At the very end of the sources, I have, Rabbi Dr. Ari Zivotofsky here yesterday. So in at least in a couple of his essays, he quotes me. So I'm going to quote him and say, I have a source from him dealing with some of the misquotations at the very end, including an article in Foie Gras at the end of all the sources over here, which when if you get a chance to read it, you'll see how many of the sources they misquote, including claiming that Rashi says it's not allowed, and all kinds of things which are really quite strange. And it's been going on for a while. No de Behuda is in source 13, is incredibly important. The No de Behuda, it's also very famous. First of all, who was he? No de Behuda's name was not Yehuda. His name was Rabbi Yecheskel Landau. He was the rabbi in Prague, probably the most important posek at the time, and just realize he lived at the same time as the Vilna Gaon and some other very prominent individuals. He was the person who dealt with all the difficult questions. He named his Shelot and Shavot the Node of Yehuda because his father's name was Yehuda. He named his commentary in the Gemara the Tzlach Tzion LeNefesh Chaya because his mother's name was Chaya. So therefore he put his mother's and father's names in his books. And he here deals with a question that he was posed by somebody who says there's a very wealthy fellow who owns lots and lots of land, and for relaxation he loves to go out hunting. What does Jewish law have to say about this? That is the question that he deals with. So I'm going to say it again. This is a very famous tshuva. It's the Nod B'Yehuda's hunting tshuva. So let's read a little bit. Michtavo kibalti v'meineni makiro. So I got a letter. I don't know the fellow. V'lo yadan alei. And because the person phrased the question with some wisdom and understanding, and it's my custom to try to answer all people who ask me, and the root of the question is, there's a fellow who God has blessed him, and he has a very, very large property, and he owns a forest. Imutar lo lelech ba'atzmo, is he allowed to go? Lirot b'kanasrefa. Kanasrefa is a rifle. Can he go and shoot? Latsud sayid, and hunt, because he enjoys hunting. Oh, im asur li Yisrael lasot davar ze imishum tzar b'lechayim imishum bal tashchit. So the question is, are you allowed to go, just go hunting? Is there a problem of bal tashchit? Is there a problem of Tzar b'lechayim? Now, we didn't talk about Baal Tashchit today, and we really don't want to talk about Baal Tashchit today, but Baal Tashchit is also one of the things which is very often misunderstood. That is a Torah law in a very narrow case, and lots of other cases, is not a law. A matter of fact, the idea, all of you know, that you can't chop down a fruit tree in your garden is not written in the Shulchan Aruch. I'm not going to say that there's no question at all. I'm just saying it happens not to be written in the Shulchan Aruch whatsoever. You want to chop down your fruit tree because you need that area to build your sukkah. So it's not written in the Shulchan Aruch that you can't do such a thing. Quite the opposite. One would be permitted to do such a thing. I'm going to leave it at that right now. But this is the way that the question is phrased. And the Nod B'Yehuda goes into this question dealing with both of these issues, really defining what is Tzar B'Lechaim on the one hand and what is Baal Tashchit on the other hand. And the reason why he's doing this is because that's really what he was asked. If you just move on toward page 5, he tells us, Harei Sheshar Hashchatot She'enu Ktzitzat Eitz Ma'achal Hurak Midvrein Be'isur Baal Tashchit. All kinds of waste of things when you're not dealing with cutting down a fruit tree is going to be Baal Tashchit on a rabbinic level, and I'm going to again say now, at most. V'amnam, ein lanu larich b'zeh, ki kfar harich mahari b'psakim k'tavim, and he goes and he quotes the same Trumat Hadeshin that we saw. He goes, we don't have to go so far into it, because the Trumat Hadeshin has already penned the important work that needs to be penned on this topic. Shekol davar sheyesh bo tzarech l'adam leit b'mishum tzar b'alei chayim. Any place where there's human benefit, there's no tzar b'alei chayim. And then he tells us something which also may be a surprise to you. Tzar Baalei Chayim is only when you leave the animal alive. He goes, if the animal is killed, there's no Tzar Baalei Chayim. How's that for a surprise that Nod B'Yehuda left us with? He goes, that's not. Killing any animals does not include Tzar Baalei Chayim. So I can assure you that many vegetarians who will tell you, no, Tzar Baalei Chayim do not include that little interesting turn of phrase over here. The Imkain, I'm skipping a little bit. There's no Tzar Baalei Chayim in this case. And it's certainly not a case of Tzar Baalei Chayim, of Baal Tashchit, because he can make benefit from the skin, and he's not doing it in a destructive manner. Baal Tashchit is destroying things where there is no benefit. If there's benefit, it's not Baal Tashchit. So it's not Tzar Baalei Chayim, it's not Baal Tashchit. So before you think he concludes, well, then that's okay. He doesn't conclude that whatsoever. And I'm skipping a little bit along the way. Next paragraph, it's on page 5. Amnam, however. Ma'od ani tama al guf hadavar. Again, why did he answer the way that he did? Because the person who asked the question said, is this Tzar Baalei Chayim or is this Baal Tashchit? But then he says, okay, now that we got your question out of the way, I'm shocked at the question. He goes, let's just think about the hunters who we have in the Torah. These are not the role models that we want to follow. Now, by the way, you could, at this point, accuse the Noda Yehuda of switching from halacha to hashkafa. The hashkafa is what's going to concern him. The halacha, he says, there's really not an issue over here. And that itself is interesting. And it's something that you need to be sensitive to when a posek is telling you, you know, this is what I see is right and wrong in the world, and this is actually what halacha says. It's actually really important when you read Shelot and Shuvot to see not just did they say yes or no, allowed or not allowed, what was the argument that was used? Ve'eich yamit ish Yisraeli b'yadayim b'alechayim b'li shum tzorech rat l'gmorchem dat zmamo Zmano letasek b'tzeda, and how could a Jewish person spend their time in doing such things? Which means he finds this morally offensive. But again, morally offensive is one thing; tzar b'alei chayim is quite another thing. At the very end of the page, ve'en kan rak lirdof achar ta'avot libo ve'itzat hanidme kitvi. He goes, and this is just following really the dark places of a person's soul. Umishu ishat tzarech lezav anasomit tzida. He goes, on the other hand, if somebody actually makes a living, let's say they sell furs and they have to go hunting, and then he actually uses an interesting halachic argument. He says that there's danger involved in hunting, and if you're doing it to make a living, so he says that's a reasonable thing to do, to put yourself in a dangerous situation, or some danger to make a living. But you're putting yourself in a dangerous situation just because you enjoy it? He says, I see no justification. And you could decide for yourselves if you think that's an incredibly strong point or not, but that actually becomes one of his final points along the way. I'm not going to read the rest of it, but you have it over here in front of you. Yeah.
In terms of the Tzar Balei Chaim issue given, though, where he says, you know, killing is not Tzar Balei Chaim. What about, you know, this is hunting, where, right. You know, I feel like that's different, let's say, than, you know, bullfights or something, where it's, you know, relatively, let's say, a pretty gruesome death to the animal, or, you know, would that be, you know, is this a broad stroke?
If we think about it, you can certainly kill an animal in a way that it's tortured and that it dies slowly and painfully, and how can that possibly not be tzar balei chayim? Let me just put it that way. So I agree with you that I do not fully understand the Noda Yehuda's point on that. But I guess what he's saying is that if you killed it in such a way that there was no pain, so there's no tzar balei chayim over here, because tzar balei chayim is only what happens before it dies, but it's not the problem of killing it, it's not tzar balei chayim. I would assume that that's what he is in fact saying. In source 16, which is the very last line, this is called Piskei HaTosfot. Okay? Piskei HaTosfot is one of these things that nobody learns. Nobody even knows where to find it. And if you have your new your Schottenstein or your Steinsaltz or whatever Gemara is today, you'll never find it. You need to find an old-fashioned Gemara that has all these commentaries in the back. One of them is something called Piskei HaTosfot, which is wonderful. What does it do? Instead of having to learn through the whole Tosfot, a Tosfot is not an easy Rishon. He asks a question, and then he asks a second question, gives an answer, gives a second answer, and sometimes it brings a whole bunch of proof and brings six other Gemaras you never learned, and therefore you get lost along the way. Piskei HaTosfot is the bottom line conclusions of all the Tosfot. So at the end of the Gemara, you can look it up over there, and source 16, Tzar Balei Chaim, Ein Asur Ela Kishimat Tzara Bali Revach. It's only Tzar Balei Chaim when there's no need for it. There's no gain from it. Which is essentially the argument that we saw in the Truman Hadeshin, comes down to Tosfot as well, and he said that in passing. The Ri, he credited the Ri, one of the Balei Tosfot, Ri HaZaken, Rashi's great-grandson, has having said this, and now you see it black and white over there. So, let's move to Rav Moshe Feinstein in source number 20. This one is often misquoted, and the way that you misquote this is simply by taking out a couple of lines here and there, take out a phrase over here, and then you can recreate this tshuva, and I can assure you, if you go looking for sources on vegetarianism, Judaism, you will find this Rav Moshe, I'm not going to say misquoted, because all the words that are there, but misquoted because of the words that were taken out. Source number 20, and let's hope that we have enough time to do this properly. And again, I'm just going to say this quick. You're having a class soon on Rav Kook. I looked at the sources. It's going to be a good class. I can already see. He doesn't need me. I don't know the fellow, but it's going to be a good class. He wrote a very nice book on it. But part of the problem with the crusade that takes place is that people overstate this. He doesn't. That's why I'm saying this. So, for example, people will claim that Rav Kook was a vegetarian. He wasn't. Rav Kook, for example, they'll say that he felt that when the Beit HaMikdash will be built, we won't have korbanot. He didn't exactly say that. Rav Kook thought that vegetarianism was a dangerous attitude because he felt in enlightened Europe they will value animals more than they value Jews, which is a fascinating thing for a person to have written years ago. Rav Kook never wrote a book on vegetarianism, but they published one because they cut and pasted from other works and they created this, again, by cutting and pasting, which is why I say this in this particular context. Rav Kook encouraged his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, who was a vegetarian, to learn Shechita. He said, a rabbi needs to learn Shechita, which is, again, is not something that you would necessarily anticipate. And Rav Kook felt that when the Beit HaMikdash is rebuilt, we'll have korbanot of animals, but eventually we won't. But why? Not because we will become more decent, but he felt that animals will evolve into becoming thinking beings and it will then become inappropriate. So, because it says, all the world will be filled with knowledge of God, and then the verse says, and the lamb will lie with the lion, and they'll come to an understanding. So he says, obviously, they're going to go through an evolutionary process, and therefore they're going to be intelligent beings, and at that point you can no longer kill them. So it's interesting how much, you know, one could take sources and sort of twist them around to produce what you want. Rav Moshe has been the victim over here. So let's read it a little bit and take a look. Source number 20. Just as far as the question that he's dealing with, he's dealing with something completely different in the question, but then, and this is written to Rav Moshe Tendler. Rav Moshe Tendler, Shadai Rafua Shlema, I heard that he was not well. Rav Moshe Tendler, if you don't know, was Rav Moshe's son-in-law and a very good friend of my father's. My father actually called me up last night to ask me to find out how he's doing. Shabbizrat Hashem, he should have Rafua Shlema. Along the way, he brings up a question of eating veal. U'b'davar ha'egalim shenitchadesh ze lo kfar shemifatmim otam kol egel b'makom miyuchad levad. The way that they're raising the veal these days, the calves, that they are in these narrow places, they can't even walk. They don't give them things that they should be eating. They've never tasted their mother's milk. They fatten them up, and the animal has no gain from this whatsoever. Lahefech, mimuvar bibucharot, and so on, including the source, for gamna sim cholim mize, utsuchim lim nerefuot. And not only is that healthy, it makes the animal sick. Now, I want to pause for a second. The way that you get Rav Moshe to say that veal is not allowed is if you present this part, you cut a lot of the things in the middle, and then you say, oh, this is tsar bei lechayim, and therefore you can't eat it. Okay? I'm just warning you, Rav Moshe doesn't say that. Rav Moshe actually has a completely different argument, which goes back very similar to what we saw in the Ramah, dealing with the goose fat. U'kfi sha'omrim shochtim mufakim lo nichshur mem ela chameshisrei agalim mimea. That this food which they're feeding it, which is causing it to fatten up, is causing it to become a trefa, and only 15% of the animals are kosher afterwards because it's so bad for the system. And those who are much more makel, others in terms of analyzing what is a trefa or not, he says they're putting it at 44%. So apparently, Rav Tendler, who, those of you who don't know, is a professor of biology, aside from being a rabbi, a very learned rabbi, and he's providing Rav Moshe with the statistics on what happens when you force feed the calves this kinds of food, you have something which is between 15 to 44% of treif, which means most of these animals are treif. Now, realize something. I don't have to get into a discussion of tsar bei lechayim anymore. Why? Because I have a much larger problem. What's my larger problem? I'm creating animals which are not kosher. So therefore, by the time this thing is going to be shechted, it's going to end up in your butcher. He's saying there's really overwhelming odds that you're dealing with a non-kosher animal. And again, let's read a little bit more to see how he's going to take this. V'hakol modim sherubam treifot. And everyone agrees that most of these animals are treif. Hefech micheske beimot shehen kashrot, which is the opposite of the norm, which is most animals are assumed to be not treif. Treif, by the way, means it has some kind of a disability that it will die by itself, by natural causes, within a year. I'm using that as a very broad definition of what is a treifa, and then there are definitions, halacha, Moshe Mi-Sinai, what those kinds of disabilities are. So it's saying is that normally most animals are considered to be kosher in terms of I don't have to go searching, I don't have to do a whole search on every part of the animal to find if it was going to die, because I assume that most animals are fine. But now I have a case that most animals are not fine, and the only question is it an overwhelming, almost impossible majority, or just a majority? He goes, and that's just that percentage of between 15 to 44% is only looking at the lungs. He goes, it's quite possible that it's developing all other types of problems. He goes, no, you have to do a whole complete analysis on this animal afterwards to see if it's in fact kosher, and not just looking at the lungs. By the way, notice the word ke'elu. And somebody who is careful about nefesh should not eat any of these kinds of animals. Even if somebody went and went searching, because what Rav Moshe is saying, if you're telling me that the percentage of sick animals is overwhelming, then just don't even go there, don't eat it. Now again, the Tzara Lechaim argument isn't there, and it's one, his argument, the thrust of the argument is because of a concern of treifa. Okay, and he's talking about the difficulty in actually checking. Regarding the people who do this, who force feed this kind of feed to the animal, they are guilty of tzar balechayim. Now, I want you to be very careful to why he brought this in. Because as I said, he just caught off a couple words here, a couple of words there, and then you come to a particular conclusion. As we all know now, that you're allowed to do things to animals where there is unimid benefit. Using animals for all kinds of human needs is allowed. But not just to cause them pain. Even though someone's going to gain from this. Now, what he means by this is that you're dealing with a procedure that the only thing that's going to happen is that the animal's health will deteriorate, but someone's going to be able to charge more money because the weight of the calf went up. So if the only human benefit is I'm going to make more money on this, Rav Moshe considers that to be wrong. He goes, that's not human benefit. That I can charge more money because I ruined the animal's health and I increased the chance that it's going to be a treifa, that's not considered human benefit. Okay, that's what Rav Moshe just now said. That somebody gets upset. And when he interested, he had a guy, wants to kill an animal. Even if you pay, listen, I want to buy this dog and kill the dog. Rav Moshe says, that's wrong. That's not just because I want to, you know, get this out of my system. I'm upset. This is therapeutic. Rav Moshe says no. That's not considered to be human benefit. I don't consider that human benefit. And listen, Rav Moshe Feinstein's allowed to make such value judgments. The laharvacha shemuter hu laachila. The kind of benefit is to eat it. Af shel acherim v'ashel anachum. Av laharog lechbol b'shvil haratzon de'ezer rasha echad asur. Even though he gains from this, even though that you're going to get paid because of the cruelty that is going to be paid out here. He says normative human benefit is what's allowed. He just defined it. He says you're allowed to. It's not Tzar Bei Lechaim with his human benefit. Rav Moshe says normative human benefit. Who decides who normative is? Okay, we could discuss that, but still, I'm interested what he says and what he doesn't say. Somebody who's upset or depressed can't go beating their animal. That's it, because that's Tzar Bei Lechaim. Skip a little bit more, turn the page. Umikol makom, nonetheless, going back, asur kedeit hashem mishum de'ein zeh mitzorchei adam shutar letzar bar lechayim, af kishalom mizikin v'gamamash, v'chein ein zeh mitzorchei adam lasot l'shekach yitzro v'chamato b'sirat v'avud chvatzim v'kelim v'nachshav zeh hashchata ba'alma, which is really echoes of the no de b'yehud that we saw. There are certain things people do, they just are destructive. He says, that's not human benefit. Destruction is not human benefit. And we want to skip a little bit. V'chein haya. Okay, let's go at the end. It's the round 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines from the top. The word starts b'chefatzav, and we're going to finish in 1 minute because we like to finish on time. Al kol pamim chazinan shelo kol devar rishadim lasot b'beima shemitzar otam af shulaver leharviach mizeh. Not everything can you do to an animal because you may have some benefit from it. Elo devar shehu hanaat adam mamash, only something which is real benefit, kishchitata behema la'achila levod behema akadoma. Like, for example, to do shchita, or to have the animal work for you. V'cheino yamutar lizanam b'dvrim sheyoter tov lahamtik et bisaro, ulehashmin et bisaro, ba'ofen she'in she'shachlu et bisaro, yanu yoter mikfi shaita ochelet shachat. I want to explain to you what the background and really what the conclusion is. What he's saying is that you're allowed to do all kinds of things where there's human benefit. The problem over here in this case that he's dealing with is that the way the animal was raised, that there's no real human benefit. Is the animal looks fatter, the meat looks better, but it's not real. In fact, he thinks that it's misrepresentation of the reality. The reality is that the animal is less healthy, more likely to be a treifa, and therefore it's tzar balei chayim in Rav Moshe's understanding. Of course, there's no human benefit involved. Again, the animal's not benefiting, it's having a cruel, terrible life. That's not enough, by the way, to make it tzar balei chayim. The human over here who's buying it is not benefiting at all because the animal's health is completely deteriorated. The only one who's gaining over here is the person who's selling the animal and getting a higher price because it looks better, and that, Rav Moshe says, that's tzar bar lechayim because there's no human benefit involved in this, which is justifiable. For you to make a little bit more money, you can't cause that pain for the animal. So again, it's interesting to see how this tshuva has been, things have been taken out of context. Rav Moshe is not saying even that the problem is how the animal was raised. He's saying that the problem is, you know, that's part of the narrative, but he's saying that is not what made it tzar bar lechayim. What makes it tzar bar lechayim over here is that there is an absence of any reasonable human benefit. Now, I'll go back to what I said in the beginning. If somebody wants to say to me, hold it, I don't want to eat an animal that was raised in this way, fine. I don't want to eat an animal who was force-fed. That's fine. But to say it's not kosher, that's not true. The arguments of not kosher or something's not kosher. Rav Moshe's main argument over here is the problem is the increased chance and risk that this animal's a treifa. That's what bothered Rav Moshe in this tshuva. That's why Rav Moshe says not to eat this because, and stay, even if you did a post-mortem and you checked afterwards, don't eat this animal if you're careful about kashrut, because the chances of not being kosher have been increased. Tzar bar lechayim, he says, animals are there for human purpose. You're allowed to cause animals pain, but that's where it's reasonable. Over here, the whole thing is a misrepresentation because you're force-fitting an animal in order to make it look better, to make more money, and that is what Rav Moshe feels is wrong. If, by the way, you fattened up the animal, and it really, it wasn't a higher risk of being a treifa, and the animal actually was one where there was human benefit, it goes back to the case of force of the foie gras, which the Ramah says was allowed. So there, and Rav Moshe is not going to pass against that. Rav Moshe agrees with that. But Rav Moshe is going to say where there's no human benefit as well, then it goes back to our problem of tzar bar lechayim. Anyway, I hope that all of this, you know, made some sense along the way. I hope that you understood the contours of the topic, even if perhaps maybe some of the smaller details we lost. You have the sources and more than you need over here to review. Yes.
From what you just said, it seems that financial gain alone is not going to be a permitter for tzar bar lechayim. Am I understanding that?
I think you're correct to use that as a conclusion, but I think that one has to look at the larger context, what's involved in it. I'm afraid to say that across the board in every case. Let's look, you know, what the reality is over here. Here he sees the larger picture. A suffering animal whose health has deteriorated, the chances of treifa have been increased, misrepresenting the animal as looking like it's healthy when the consumer goes and buys it. And the only one gaining over here is the person who's selling it. He goes, no, there's something wrong with this whole picture, and that Rav Moshe doesn't allow. Okay? Yes?
I'm assuming things like dog fighting and that sort of thing are...
We don't like those things.
Even if there's financial gain for the consumers?
Yeah, and that takes us right back to at least that pasuk with the Moshe of Leitzim and so on, the way that Rashi understood it, or the Gemara, or the other commentaries there understood that you go to the Colosseum and the animals are fighting one another, that seemed to be something which was at least morally detestable.